Hey folks, welcome to this week's podcast. Michael Shelley here. I've got three guests today trying to do something a little bit different, talking about three bands I love, three authors, and three books written in completely different styles, and three guys with completely different styles as well. So something interesting. These are all very short, and hopefully you'll find something interesting. And if you want more information about all this stuff, look at the books, buy the books, take them out of the library, or go to the website, go to wfmu.org/Michael, find the playlist for this program, and there's links to all of these guys' websites for more information about what other projects they're doing in these books in particular. First, we have Tom Smucker talking about why the Beach Boys matter. After that, Ian Rustin about the Rolling Stones in concert. And finally, Harvey Kubernick and his book called The Story of the Band. Enjoy all three of these. I guess I'll talk to you soon. That's it. All right, there are the Beach Boys, and as I promised, the first of three guest authors today, Tom Smucker. He is a longtime music writer, written for Cream and Rolling Stone and Village Voice and a bunch of stuff, and you've got sort of a blog and a website over at tomsmucker.org. Good morning, Tom. How are you?
I'm doing good. Thanks. Thanks for calling.
The book is called Why the Beach Boys Matter from the University of Texas Press, and it's the first of a series. I've gotten two of them so far. They're nice, kind of small little books, and I wouldn't say that they're short, but they're not long. And I asked the publicity guy over there what the purpose of the series is, why the other one is, the number two is Why the Ramones Matter. And he sent over this statement, and I'm completely paraphrasing now, but the books are supposed to talk about the importance of the band and examine their musical, cultural, and personal impact of the band, and that's kind of what this book does. To me, it reads like almost like a bunch of magazine articles about the Beach Boys. Is that sort of right?
Yeah, I agree with that. And I am not a biographer. I did not interview the Beach Boys for this. I was trying to write as a fan and the person who's thought a lot about them and read about them and listened to them and gone to their concerts. And so I was just trying to hit a bunch of different points about why I thought they were important. And I agree with you. It's like a bunch of different magazine articles, and hopefully it all adds up in the reader's mind as giving my case for why they're important and trying to add my part as a fan, because they're important to me, you know, and for somebody else, maybe something else is important. Maybe they kind of like the Beach Boys. Maybe they don't like the Beach Boys at all. But, you know, I think that's one of the great things about listening to pop music. You can have something you identify with closely. You want to share it with other people. But, you know, in the next room, there's people listening to something different.
Yeah, certainly on FMU, that's for sure.
Yes, I agree with that. Yes, for sure.
One of the things I can't remember, but somewhere in the book I read, you're sort of talking, I think, about different books and about all the, throughout time, the cultural interpretation published about the Beach Boys changes, and you refer to something as another way to try to make sense of the Beach Boys, which I thought was real smart, because, like you said, it is a personal interpretation to everyone at a certain point. So what Yes. did you learn something going through this and going through their career, and you sort of write about their cultural impact, and you write about the music and the personalities and what they all meant to you? What did you learn sort of having to go through the process of putting it all together?
One thing I learned that was really interesting to me is how at a certain point when they'd gone out of fashion, there was a bunch of fans, really, and some of them became newsletter writers or fan club presidents and eventually journalists. The two I mention in the book the most are David Leaf and Dominic Priori. But there's a whole bunch of people, and of course many of them are in L.A., and they kind of pull this story together themselves at a point where the Beach Boys are kind of not in the mix in the United States anyway. And that part is really interesting to me, how in pop music, the fans themselves can become a force that says, no, this music is really good. Here's one way to listen to it. Here's what's really going on. So all of that, I think when I step back and looked at this, that stepped out to me as, wow, that's kind of interesting, that's one of the Beach Boys stories.
In the book, you sort of talk about other writings about the band, as I mentioned earlier. What do you think is the most wrong-headed idea about the band that's that you've read?
Well, probably the most wrong-headed is they have no significance, and that's come and gone. But I do want to work in here that I appreciate, you know, I am a devoted fan of Brian Wilson. I do not know any of these people personally. I don't know what goes on behind the scenes other than what I've read. But I support your noble goal of not making Mike Love a demonic figure that's, you know, only ruining things. You know, I think if you listen to all of their music and follow their career, there's a lot of moments there where Mike does some pretty important stuff, particularly his early lyrics, and every once in a while in the later songs. And for those of us that have seen them over the years, there were some years there where Mike was really the stage presence. So I think that storyline that, and again, I don't know these people and who was not nice to who, you know, I'm not going to deny any of that, but I think that storyline that it's just Brian Wilson and the rest of the band are kind of accidental participants. I don't agree with that at all, no.
Yeah. Well, I mean, I think if we judge Mike solely on his behavior, it would be pretty negative. But yes, the part of the story that gets me is when people deny his creative contributions to the band.
That's right.
It's ridiculous. And it's gotten to some sort of strange fever. You mentioned Mike Love's name and people go nuts. And
yes.
I'm just strictly talking about his musical contributions to the band. Tom Smucker is our guest. The book is called Why the Beach Boys Matter, and it's the first of a whole series of books that you might want to look into. TomSmucker.org is the website. I think you can order the book off there and take a look at all your work up there. Thanks for joining us, and I know you're a WFMU listener, and I appreciate that, and good luck with the book. Thank you, Tom.
Okay, thank you very much, Michael. Have a good day.
Joining us on the telephone, our second of three authors, Ian Rustin. The book is called The Rolling Stones in Concert, 1962 to 1982, a show-by-show history. You may remember that Ian was on the show a few years ago when he co-wrote a similar book called Beach Boys in Concert. And I love that book because by looking at the concert history of the band, you get a different avenue into the history of the band, and it was sort of just a delightful surprise. This book is the same, traces the history of this band. I imagine it was just an incredible amount of work. Where did you start?
Well, I started, it was a little different from the Beach Boys book because you can find lists of all the Rolling Stone shows, you know, so that was a little easier. With the Beach Boys, I had to actually like do detective work to find out where they played, you know. But with the Rolling Stones, I had the list of concerts that turned out to be mostly correct. However, nobody had ever written a book like this that detailed all their shows. So I had to do the same sort of thing I did with the Beach Boys book. Go to libraries, pull up reviews in old moldy newspapers or from magazines like the Melody Maker and New Musical Express, and read every single book that has come out about the Rolling Stones. I also went back and listened to all the albums again, including a few that I hadn't actually owned. You know, I went and bought them, and I even bought all the DVDs and things that have come out, some of which I had, you know, didn't have, just so I could make sure I was telling the story correctly.
There's info in the book about opening acts and set lists and travel itineraries and stuff like that. And the book condenses all these reviews and lots of news reporting also. And it's interesting to me to read the reviews of the shows, especially the negative ones. It's kind of you forget about that this band wasn't always just this sort of spectacle. You know, their tours now are sort of more of a spectacle. Back then, especially in the early days, they were taken seriously, and each show was reviewed like a cultural event. And one of the things I really appreciate about the book was the very, very early history, because at a certain point, their whole career, every second of it, is documented. But the early stuff, there was a real window into how the band formed. Even before the five guys, the classic lineup, was formed, the book starts just before that, right?
Right. Well, you know, yeah. So I started out, you know, I did a similar thing with the Beach Boy book. We have sort of introductory chapters introducing each year, and then we go into show by show for each year.
Were you able to determine how touring has changed, you know, just the mechanics of it?
Yeah, well, that's what I find that really interesting, you know, that like, I even have an interview clip where Ian Stewart is talking about that. He's saying about, he talks in the interview, he's sort of complaining. He's a bit of a curmudgeon, I think. And he was complaining that in the old days, it was just them and maybe one of their manager, the original manager was Andrew Oldham, and maybe a road manager or a roadie, you know, and that was about it. So they traveled with like just like seven people on the road in the 60s, you know. And then he was complaining that by, you know, the early 70s, all of a sudden they were traveling with like two airplanes full of people, you know, as many as like 60 or 70 people. And he wasn't even sure what all their jobs were. He just knew that it was ridiculous, you know, that this sort of excess, it became this sort of circus traveling around from town to town, you know, taking up whole hotels, you know, all the rooms in a hotel and, you know, and things like that. It got pretty crazy. But it started out with just, you know, the band in a car with maybe their manager and a roadman, you know, a roadie and a road manager, and that was about it.
In doing the research and putting the book together, were there surprises, or what was the biggest surprise, thing you didn't know or thing you were surprised to learn?
I think in a way, writing a book, you know, like that, I learned more about the band, you know, and I guess I came to appreciate more periods of the band that I hadn't appreciated before. I think that when I started writing, you know, I've always loved the 1960s classic Rolling Stones and pretty much all those records. And like a lot of people, you know, easy thing to say is that, you know, around after Exile on Main Street, which is their 1972 double album, a lot of people say they started to kind of be less consistent, and they think that a lot of their 70s albums weren't as good. But I came to have a lot of respect for a couple of those albums that I had sort of, you know, disregarded before, especially, I think Goat's Head Soup 1973 is a really good album, actually. And I like also It's Only Rock and Roll from 1974. And you know, then I realized that even, you know, up through, you know, Tattoo You in 1981, I think most of the albums are pretty good, you know. I think after that, it's a bit more hit or miss for me. But also, just to see the number shows, and I listened to a lot of tapes, and that the quality of the Stones really was maintained, you know. Even today, I think, you know, they put on a great show. I don't know how many bands really you can say are as consistent about putting out a decent product live as them.
It's so interesting you say that, because to me, I've never seen them live, and you'd have to give me a money-back guarantee to go, because the last few times I've seen film of them, they've been terrible, and I mean on any level terrible, just not together. And maybe I've just seen a few bad clips, but it seems to me the last few years, the last tours, they're just a disaster. They're almost a parody of themselves. But obviously you've seen a lot more of their lineup than I have.
Yeah, well, I mean, I say in the book, and I'll stick by it, that I think Ron Wood is a talented musician and guitarist, but I do think that once he joined, I feel like the band lost a certain, it started to develop a more like kind of just rock band sound, maybe, you know, like a more shambolic thing, like the Faces or something, and stopped having the kind of, almost, okay, you know, the ability to do a whole bunch of different genres that they'd been able to do with Brian Jones, the original guitarist, and then with Mick Taylor, who replaced him. A delicacy was lost, you know. And so if the Stones are having a bad night, they can be very sloppy, you know. It's like with this lineup, you know, and you know, but I still think that when the mood is right, they occasionally are able to do a great show, you know. I mean, I think also, though, I should point out obviously it would be incredible to have seen them back in the day, like in smaller clubs or small theaters, you know. And I think the fact that they, for good or bad, became a stadium band is just a drawback. You know, I mean, there's no doubt that seeing a band in Chase Stadium is not the same as seeing a band play, you know, in like, let's say, the New York's Town Hall or something. That would be a way better place to see the Rolling Stones.
Well, one of the things the book chronicles is they would often do warm-up shows in these tiny little clubs that, you know, in the days leading up to a huge tour. And you can imagine, right. I think they still do that. And it is a shame that they are forced, or that they've chosen because they like money, to play in these giant places where it's sort of hard to put over their songs, I think. It just doesn't translate to 50,000 people. It just sounds horrible. To me.
Yeah, I know what you mean. It's true. I mean, you know, that's the thing. That's why, like, to see those kind of gigs is awesome if you're able to see them. I never had that opportunity, but I know people that have. I mean, and they say, you know, that's like so different to see them in, like, you know, a 1,000-seat hall instead of a 50,000-seat stadium is like probably like night and day. I think Keith Richards even has admitted that. I saw an interview where he was saying, this band really is a club band. This is where they're at their best. But
yeah,
you know, but the truth,
absolutely, yeah.
But yeah, but I mean, but he did say something which is true. He said, if we came into New York and we tried to play a 1,000-seat club, there'd be so much demand that we'd have to play there like 30 days. So it makes more sense to play a stadium where you can play two shows, you know, and accommodate all the demand. It's just, I think, quality suffers.
They could play the Beacon Theater for a week or so, or, you know, do what Bruce Springsteen, I don't know. There's a million ways to do it. They're going strictly for the money, and don't believe anything Keith Richards says about, you know, he's a liar. Ian Rustin is our guest. The book is called The Rolling Stones in Concert, 1962 to 1982, a show by Show History. It's published by McFarland. Thanks for joining us and giving us some interesting insight into this band, who's on tour again.
Yes. Thank you so much, Michael.
Okay, folks, there is the band, and finally we have number three of three authors on the program today. Harvey Kupernick is, boy, you've done a lot. I was looking at your website, cavehollywood.com. You are certainly a prolific music journalist, sometimes musician, A&R executive, but for, I think there's about 14 books and a million articles up on your website, and the new book is called The Story of the Band, From Big Pink to the Last Waltz, which chronicles the career of the band from 1966 to 1976, and one of the things that struck me when I was reading the book, and by the way, it's an just a gorgeous, beautiful book, is lucky for you that the band only existed for such a short time, because it lets you completely crystallize their whole career in one book.
Thank you for the praise. Good morning to everybody. Let's just call this a period piece book, because I was really focusing on that 10-year period, 66 to 1976. And wasn't psychically, or shall we say, contractually obligated to really give us the wrap-up of the last 40 years, the various reissues, re-releases, truncated digital music, solo albums, and you know what I'm talking about. So on this one, it was very defined, and so we're not going into the usual world of creating maybe a more of a balance where we have to kind of deal with the last 30 and 40 years and even posthumous deaths and rebirths and, you know, career and new labels. And so I think you get the band and their recorded catalog and the trajectory of their life, you know, as Livon and the Hawks paired with Bob Dylan, and then this kind of 1968 to 1976 period where they are the band.
Yeah, it's very fascinating, and you know, I'm a fan of them, and I thought I knew a lot, but there's so much in here, and the way it's laid out, the format of the book is really unusual. It's almost sort of like a scrapbook. There's just tons and tons of short interviews and little pieces and reproductions of visual things that sort of help tell the story and, like you said, move it along in this sort of chronological way. I didn't realize that The Last Waltz is 40 years old and their debut album is 50 years old, but of course they started much earlier than that, and that's one of my favorite parts of the book, is the stuff about the very, very early days when they're working with Ronnie Hawkins. Just so interesting.
One of the reasons I do these books, we're at number 15,
And I really can look at you. I mean, you're 3,000 miles away, or I could talk to you and say, I'm in it for the challenge and the risk. And before I embarked on this banned book, I would say there were a half a dozen people I know, friends, and then some fans that would come up to me, what are you working on? What's your next book? You know, I have this, we'll call it a demographic. And I would say the band, and everybody would say, well, hasn't there been a couple of books on the band already? What are you going to do? And I said, you're talking to Harvey Kubernick. You mean there's two books out, or three maybe? One's 25 years old. None of them have had 100 color photos or been this format, which I know you cherish. You mean you think the story's already been written? Are you Meshuggah? And you've already said it to me, and it's the best compliment I can receive, which I'm getting daily. I thought I knew a whole lot about the band already. You are a musician. You're a record buff. You're a geek. You're a collector. You're a radio guy. All your friends, you thought you had it wired, didn't you? And all of a sudden, you've learned 50 to 100 new pieces of information, not counting the 150 visuals, and it's not sorted information or about the dysfunctional musicians. It's recording, it's technical, it's anecdotal, it's regional. And when you really devour the book, somebody like you must say, I didn't know all this West Coast stuff was going on top of the migration and the expedition through the world of Ronnie Hawkins.
Like you mentioned, there's just tons of unpublished interviews and little short pieces of people that worked with the band that really helped tell the story in first-person witness testimony, which I think makes it really compelling to read the story. Was there stuff that you yourself, what's the most interesting thing you yourself didn't know before you started this project?
There are a couple, but the one thing, I don't want to say it blew my mind, but it got pretty close to it. I had always heard for many decades that a musician named John Ware, who worked with Chris Darrow of the Kaleidoscope and Linda Ronstadt, and I think he was with Emmylou Harris as a drummer for, I think, 13 years. And I know him as a musician. I always knew he was kind of a fan of Ronnie Hawkins and the band, and that he actually had seen Ronnie Hawkins with the Hawks with his good pal Jesse Ed Davis. So Chris Darrow gave me his email, and I said, I'm doing a book on the band. Did you ever run into any of the guys in the band out on the West Coast? And I was just amazed, and I gave it a sidebar in the book, because I picked the sidebars and the pull quotes and everything, that he told me that he spent 3 months, at least 3 months, in a group in Venice, California, in Lena Ronstadt's house, playing with LaVon Helm in a group where he actually got switched over to bass. And LaVon was one of his heroes, who was his drum teacher in Arkansas. That's the connective tissue that I really like to find. But as I glanced at a couple of the early band books and read some articles, it always seemed like LaVon Helm quit the band or quit the Hawks before this 1966 global tour with Bob Dylan. And then he was summoned off an oil rig in Arkansas or something to join the band in maybe late 68 for them, sometime in late 67 maybe, or early 68, to play with the Hawks and Bob Dylan at this famous Woody Guthrie tribute concert at Carnegie Hall. Who knew that he did 3 months out here in a band with these guys, and John had such details of repertoire and specifics that it was just nice to know that he, and somebody yesterday emailed me and said, I read that thing about John Ware and LaVon Helm, and you're almost immediately prepared to put your dukes up to kind of fight for this one. And he said, did you know LaVon played for a week with Jimmy Garstein and a bunch of people and all these Okies out here with Leon Russell? He was in the kind of a group out here before he did the John Ware thing. These are the kind of things that I like.
There's just great history in this book, great pictures to sort of put it all together. And like you said, little pull quotes and stuff. It's fascinating. Harvey Kubernick, the book, once again, is called The Story of the Band for Big Pink to Last Waltz. Folks can make a good a good coffee table book or because it's huge. It's like a, I want people to understand.
And it is reasonably priced,
it's
too.
Go to cavehollywood.com for information on this book and on everything raconteur Harvey Kupernik is up to. And it sounds like you're up to a lot.
Well, close to 6 feet, almost 5'11". Oh, up to a lot? Yeah. No, working away on, I write a lot for cavehollywood.com, and I also do the cover stories for the last 10 years of Record Collector News, and there's a new story out I've done. I've done a cover story that comes out, the December-January issue is the cover story in the Beatles' White Album, and I've been writing about Howlin' Wolf, and I've been writing, I let it go into the universe, or the Looniverse, as Andrew Lou Goldham calls it, and it seems to land somewhere, but really enjoyed your enthusiasm to this book, and I know that you are a historian, but I'm pretty sure somebody like you was pretty amazed at the detail into Gold Star and knowing that part of Big Pink or the sessions were done at Gold Star, let alone the mixing and recording on the Gold on Capitol Records 8-track studios in Hollywood. So it wasn't all this mythic Woodstock, you know, forest world, which I totally respect. But L.A. and Hollywood had a lot to do with these records being recorded.
Yeah, I think that's part of the interesting history. The story of the band from Big Pink to the Last Waltz is the book. For more information, folks, go visit cavehollywood.com. Harvey, thanks for taking a minute of your morning to speak with us, and good work on the book.
Thank you very much. Anytime. Paper and pen, telling us our hard times are about.
tempo sounds slow, John. I think we're warmed up.